Hi, Patrick here with a no-frills slap-it-together pod today. It's been busy in our newsroom. Today, a couple of takes on the narrative of Osama bin Laden, how a multitude of words and not-so-subtle rhetoric from many perspectives are vying to give meaning to bin Laden and his legacy. Also, the future of translation at the US military. Alex puts one of those instant translation gizmos through its paces.
Do you have any weapons?
And my hovercraft is full of eels too.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
I'm here with Patrick, and it's time to talk words. New words, old words, censoring everything.
The World in Words podcast and The Big Show, the World Radio program, they're both co-productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH here in Boston. We're at theworld.org online. This podcast is at theworld.org/language. I also put blog posts at patrickcox.wordpress.com. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is patrickcox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X. And there's a World in Words Facebook page. And please get in touch with me via any of those places and let me know what you'd like me to cover in future podcasts and send me your comments on stuff that I've already done. So today, first, Osama bin Laden, the myth, the legacy, the rhetoric, then the Pentagon's search for an instant translation device, and also Peru's gloomy national anthem and one man's quixotic mission to make it a little bit happier. Okay, so first, the big news, the death of Osama bin Laden and the pod's take on it. And President Obama had some very interesting news this week. He said he decided not to release photos of bin Laden's body for the U.S. government. Of course, there were pros and cons on that. The absence of a photo is bound now to add to the mythology surrounding bin Laden's life and his death. But of course, the presence of a photo would also have influenced those things. The amount of words pouring out of people's mouths on who bin Laden was and what he stood for is quite astounding right now. And there's clearly a rhetorical sort of battle of all battles taking place right now as everybody vies to try and just frame who this guy was. And you can see that in the very aggressive language that came out of the White House initially, which they then had to pull back from. It was inaccurate. And it seems as though the Obama administration believed that it just simply could waste no time in setting down the boundaries of the narrative of bin Laden. Well, we have two takes on this today. We're going to hear from The Big Show's Marco Werman in a little bit. But first, here's Jason Margolis on how the bin Laden myth evolved and on the battle to write the final script.
The life of Osama bin Laden lends itself to myth. The young man who gave up a world of riches for a life of uncertainty and risk as a freedom fighter. In the past decade, bin Laden carefully crafted his own image.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of God, the Most.
We've all seen the Al-Qaeda videos of bin Laden, this one broadcast by Al Jazeera, wandering through the mountains, a rugged ascetic waging holy war against the mighty United States. That myth was shattered for many in the United States this week with the details of bin Laden's death. Here's comedian John Stewart.
You know, he was living in some staid and upscale Pakistani suburb for some time when we got him. You know, this guy's out there preaching suicide bombings and jihad, pretending he's Gandalf wandering the frontier, all the while living like one of the housewives of Orange County.
And then there was the story of how bin Laden actually died. Matthew Baum, a professor of global communications at Harvard, says even in his final seconds, the U.S. government was trying to cast bin Laden as an anti-hero.
You know, why is it that I know about the fact that, well, whether if it's a fact that he tried to use one of his wives as a shield? I can't imagine that's an accident that I know that little factoid. It's a great way to make him look cowardly.
Shortly after I spoke with Baum, the White House changed the story of how bin Laden died, saying he did not use one of his wives as a human shield, and that bin Laden was unarmed. I called Baum back after the story changed.
It makes it a more complicated story, and complex is bad in the messaging business. It makes it less unambiguously clean, heroic, good, whatever, you know, adjective you want to use, and a little muddier.
It's hard to say whether U.S. officials got the story mixed up or deliberately tried to spin the narrative. Had the story gone down the way we originally heard, a cowardly bin Laden hiding behind his wife, it would have been a tidy ending to the narrative of bin Laden. Even though bin Laden was already evil incarnate to most Americans, those last few moments still matter, says Paul Argenti. He's a professor of corporate communication at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth.
It's a way to kind of center anger and to center people on the idea that a mission has been accomplished, to give the understanding that you can conquer evil, that, you know, the good guys win and the bad guys lose. I think there's a lot of things that go into that, and you don't really want that to end. You know, the story will be it started on 9/11 and it ended on May 1.
In the Muslim world, the myth of bin Laden's death has evolved very differently and still is, says British historian Simon Sebag Montefiore.
There will be huge myths, whether he died at all. He will be seen repeatedly in places. There will be shrines to him. And the fact that there is no body will only add to the mystery.
Some are calling for more concrete proof, like photos or video, to be released. That seems unlikely after President Obama's decision not to release the photos. Peter Taylor, the author of Talking to Terrorists, A Personal Journey from the IRA to Al-Qaeda, doubts whether the U.S. will ever release images that might bolster the heroic myth of bin Laden.
If he wasn't armed, if his wife was trying to protect him, and then he was shot down in cold blood, murdered by the Zionist and the great Satan, then, of course, the propaganda myth will be even greater. The danger is that bin Laden will become a more powerful, inspirational, and recruiting symbol for young Muslims around the world in death than he ever was in life.
And there's another risk for the U.S. The government can't control how people will interpret its accounts of the raid, says Matthew Baum at Harvard.
Sometimes we're decent at influencing those things, but more often than not, it has a life of its own, and we're more bystanders. Occasionally, we make it worse. But I don't think we are anywhere near sufficient masters of rhetoric and propaganda to control the myth.
Still, Baum says the U.S. will try. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
So, okay, the narrative of bin Laden that the U.S. government is telling, in a way, sounds quite simple and straightforward, even given the back and forth on exactly the circumstances of how he died. But if you cast your mind back to 9/11/2001, the story was really anything but clear-cut. There were so many aspects to the events of that day and to the pronouncements from bin Laden in the intervening years that it caused a lot of people, myself included, to scratch their heads and try to shake themselves awake. I mean, what?
It blew out the middle of the building, a huge fireball. It was there 1 second, and then it just exploded.
I came across a lady. She doesn't even remember her name. She was just covered in blood. Her face is like all burnt from here. I've never been in a combat situation, but this is about close as you can ever get.
A coherent narrative requires a degree of realism. It requires leading characters with motives that are understandable and explicable. And those were missing 10 years ago. It's taken that long to, you know, fill in the blanks. We have constructed our storyline since then, though I do think for a lot of people there is still some fuzziness. Here's The Big Show's Marco Werman, who starts his report with a key question.
How do you celebrate the death of someone who had brought the United States to its knees?
I want justice. And there's an old poster out west, as I recall, that said, wanted, dead or alive.
Several nights after Mr. Bush issued the dead or alive proclamation for Osama bin Laden in September 2001, musicians and actors gathered on national television.
Nothing to kill or die for.
They sang down-tempo tunes, made solemn pronouncements, and generally crystallized a new national sobriety. Culturally, it was telegraphed that things would now be different for the U.S. and the world. So what changed?
After 9/11, I think there was an immediate response.
That's David Peisner, a contributing editor at the music magazine Spin. Musicians, he says, reflected the uncertainty among everyone here in the U.S. about what had happened and how to react to bin Laden.
You know, there were benefit concerts, there were things like that. But once the country sort of settled into what's going on, I think it took people and it took the arts community a while to kind of find their feet. If you think about, especially the music community, began speaking out against the, Bush and took a fairly, you know, anti-Bush slant. But it took a long time for that to happen.
When Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941, the U.S. knew immediately who had done that. 9/11 was different. Insiders knew pretty quickly who was in charge of the attacks. But the idea that a man like Osama bin Laden, thousands of miles away, could do this was a whole new concept for Americans. That bin Laden and his methods were so different was in itself powerful, says Lawrence Wright, a longtime bin Laden watcher, writes at The New Yorker and the author of The Looming Tower.
The imagery that he drummed up, which is a man in a cave declaring war on America, was very powerful. And of course, for many Americans, it just seemed absurd that somebody with such a disproportionate lack of power could hope to wage any kind of campaign against America. On the other hand, that imagery resonated with a lot of Muslims for whom the cave is very significant, because that's where the Prophet Muhammad received his instructions to write the Quran, and that's where he took refuge. And so there was a lot of imagery that bin Laden was playing upon.
Imagery that, according to Wright, a lot of Americans didn't understand, even some in the U.S. intelligence community. Many Americans simply wanted vengeance. As Wright explains, many people around the world, like victims of the 1998 al-Qaeda bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, also are celebrating based on what they've lived through.
There's no doubt that we have been seeking vengeance, and in some respects we've achieved it. I think it's appropriate to say that we're glad he's gone. And I think, you know, it's appropriate to remember the victims that have, there's so many thousand of them, not just Americans, but all over the world, and so many of them are Muslim. In fact, the preponderance of them are. The cries of USA, USA, you know, just think about those 150 blind Africans that are in Nairobi. Well, you know, we should be remembering that, you know, they have reason to celebrate as well.
The news of Osama bin Laden's death produced a wide range of emotions. Celebration in front of the White House was one of the first gut reactions. Here's David Peisner of Spin magazine again.
I guess I was initially taken aback just momentarily at the sight of people in the streets cheering bin Laden's death, only for the idea that, you know, you just don't see that. You don't see people in America cheering somebody's death. But I think in some ways that speaks to the country's need to find something to cheer about and to find something that they can all agree on. I mean, you've got Washington completely divided, but there's no one that doesn't agree on the idea that bin Laden is better dead than alive.
For The World, I'm Marco Werman.
Wow, amazing how quickly the rhetoric changes. The chants of USA, USA, they took a lot of people by surprise. And they've been playing badly, of course, in certain parts of the world, viewed as naive triumphalism. But they're also a sign of a return of something to American speech. I suppose it's self-confidence. I mean, just consider what happened to the U.S. in the past 10 years since 9/11. Not only did it fail until just now to get bin Laden, it also got mired in what many people believe were unwinnable wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which meant that Americans became even less popular abroad than they had been. And then on top of that, the economy tanked really badly and China surged. No wonder that people expressed relief when they heard about bin Laden's death. Now, it'll be down to politicians to try to capture that sense of renewed whatever it is. And it looks like in the short term, Obama, as commander-in-chief, is the big beneficiary. Okay, now on to language learning and interpretation inside the U.S. military. And it's precisely because of those wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that this has been so much on the minds of Pentagon chiefs. The Pentagon's research arm, DARPA, is seeking to develop an instant translator device for real-time communications in the field of battle. So the big show's Alex Gallafent decided to try out a couple of prototypes. This, by the way, is the second in his two-part examination of how the Pentagon approaches foreign languages. I want to say how the Pentagon teaches foreign languages, except in this week's report, the idea is really to consider alternatives to learning a language. Here goes.
The U.S. military has been producing specialist interpreters for decades. People who spend years learning Arabic, Chinese, and other challenging languages. They're the kind of people Rai Barkot depended on. He's a former Marine captain who served in Iraq. For Barkot, there's no substitute for having a flesh-and-blood interpreter by your side when you're gathering intelligence, specifically a trusted linguist who can translate all aspects of a conversation, the verbal and the nonverbal. But as Barkot points out, few units, especially in the infantry, have access to human interpreters. Machine translation could help, with basic information at least.
You know, when a Marine or Army unit's out patrolling and they need to ask a person for permission to enter their property, for example, it's far better to have a machine than not have anything.
So in recent years, the U.S. military has adopted a policy of trying to give everyone who deploys some knowledge, something to hang their hat on.
Hello, and thank you for your interest in learning more about vCommunicator Mobile, the first deployed and fielded military mobile application.
This is one of a growing range of products out there designed to bridge the military language gap. Ernie Bright is the product manager for vCommunicator Mobile, which runs on a modified iPod Touch. He says the focus was on assisting soldiers, not distracting them.
We knew that they were needing a more mobile, easy-to-use type product that would allow them to learn key tactical phrases and also be able to just pick it up and use it.
Silence has turned it on. Currently the language is Pashto. Tap to talk, it says. Do you have any weapons?
It's impressive, but it's not the only translation device out there vying for a potentially lucrative military contract. Another mobile app is called SpeechTrans. Here's the company's co-founder, Jan Auerbach. Via Skype, he told me how SpeechTrans works.
It allows you to speak into the device in your native language. It'll translate and speak aloud the translation instantly.
Auerbach gives me a demonstration.
So, Alex, it is a pleasure speaking with you today. I'm glad that we're able to get together on this topic.
SpeechTrans draws on a massive archive of voice samples, but it doesn't yet cover every language, or, crucially with languages such as Arabic, every dialect. Jan Auerbach tells me his company is now in the running for a Pentagon project called BOLT, Boundless Operational Language Translation. The goal for BOLT is lofty. Technology that would recognize not just dialects, but localized slang too. Now that still leaves a lot of missing information. Gestures, body language. It's something Ernie Bright and the vCommunicator Mobile team have been thinking about.
The focus is a lot on the nonverbal side of communication.
On his device, for every piece of language, you get an animated video demonstrating the appropriate gesture. It's meant to help soldiers learn the language, too.
Because they can remember, oh, this phrase coincides with this gesture or this body language.
That's fine for stock phrases at checkpoints and the like. But soldiers have to interpret gestures as much as they have to reproduce them. And they have to do it in the blink of an eye. Could a machine ever do that work, too? When it comes to translation technology, no one yet knows where the lines will be drawn. All languages, all communications, are built on ever-shifting sands of meaning. That meaning can't ever be fully, totally captured by technology. But as translation tech accelerates, it might fool us into believing otherwise. And so for the military, the dream of a universal translating machine will be ever more tantalizing. The trick will be knowing when to use the gadgets and when to put them aside. For The World, I'm Alex Galifant.
Okay, finally today, Peru's sorry national anthem. Well, it's not so much sorry as a bit sorry at the start, the first verse. But that's the only one that anyone sings. And so, they sing about slavery, about humiliation, and a couple of other horrors. And that's just not fitting for a country that happens to be right now riding an economic boom. Here's John Otis.
Largo tiempo el peruano oprimido. La ominosa cadena arrastró.
That's Julio César Rivera, a retired government accountant, singing the opening lines of the Peruvian national anthem.
Largo tiempo.
For a long time, he sings, the oppressed Peruvian dragged the ominous chain. Condemned to cruel servitude, he quietly whimpered. It's supposed to be a patriotic homage to the fatherland, but Rivera describes Peru's national anthem as a colossal bummer.
Las letras del himno nacional de mi país no son nada positivas.
The words are not at all positive, Rivera says, and it's one of the factors that affects our national spirit.
Este es el video, este es el CD, y este es el libro.
Rivera spent the last 10 years, as well as thousands of dollars, researching the anthem, penned in 1821. He has self-published two thick books about the song's history. Like many South American anthems, he says, it resembles a mini-opera, long and dramatic, but with a heroic finish. But in public performances, no one sings all seven stanzas. So, Peruvians never get to hear the more inspiring lyrics about rising up and seizing independence from Spain. Rivera wants to scrap the lyrics and replace them with some of his own.
Es con la misma música. Y dice así. Con justicia vivamos en paz, igualdad y libertad.
Rivera has written three new verses set to the old music that speak of justice, liberty, and the good things Peru has given to humanity. He's even cut a CD of his new anthem featuring a classical tenor.
Honremos a padres y héroes, solidarios hicieron la nación.
But Rivera's crusade has met resistance.
Most of the people don't want to change the lyrics of the anthem, you know, because we don't pay so much attention to that.
To Lima analyst José Luis Sardón, the anthem seems appropriate given Peru's often tragic history. It was here where Spanish conquistadors crushed the Incan Empire. Later, in the 19th century War of the Pacific, Peru lost a huge patch of mineral-rich territory to Chile.
In most of the history, Peruvians have been very depressive people, because we have lost all wars, especially the war with Chile was quite traumatic for us.
Si quieres cambiar el himno de raíz, tendrías que refundar.
Lima columnist Inesio López says before creating a more upbeat national anthem, Peru itself must change. Amid the economic bonanza, more than a third of Peruvians still survive on $2 or less a day.
Para al menos los de abajo no cambia, ¿no?
For poor people, nothing has changed, López says, and that goes against this optimistic outlook. The Peruvian government did tweak the national anthem in 2009. Instead of changing the lyrics, officials decreed that the sunnier sixth verse should be sung in place of the oppressive first verse. Rivera takes me to a Lima high school where students sing the updated anthem on the first day of classes. With its references to the flag and the Andes Mountains, the new lines are more cheerful. But Rivera can't stop lobbying for his own lyrics. Rivera takes up the issue with the high school music teacher, and before leaving, he presses a CD of his new and improved national anthem into the teacher's hands. For The World, I'm John Otis, Lima.
Okay, that's it. See you on Twitter and Facebook, or theworld.org/language. Or you can send me an email. The address is language@pri.org. See you next week.